Welcome to another edition of the Baseball America podcast. You got your usual crew here today, J.J. Cooper and John Manuel. I guess we can go back to saying we're the usual crew.
I think we are the usual crew. We're the A crew. I do miss the days of the John Manuel Will Lingo podcast and the Matt Myers Alan Matthews podcast. I'm slighting you by saying I miss those days, but I enjoy your guest spot on the Matt Myers Alan Matthews. I didn't even think I was going to get it. That was an awesome. That's the all-time best podcast we ever did.
Which is Aaron now Fit, like non, 7 years ago.
It is, but non-Aaron Fit Rage.
Yes, that will be the
those
news.
Are always good when Aaron rages against
the. We may have some rage today because today we're going to talk the topic of the day. We're going to get into other stuff. We're going to answer some questions afterwards, but the main thing that we're going to start with today is how can you not. We're recording this on Wednesday morning in the – I guess it's still just – it has not officially been announced. The press conferences have not gone on yet. But the mega deal, the Blue Jays
– mega deal.
The Blue Jays and Marlins get together for one of the largest trades, you know, we can remember.
It's really amazing that, JJ, in the span of like 3 months, we've had two of the biggest money dumps in the history of the game. I mean, I know the money's bigger in the game now, but it's hard to conceive – of two trades like we've seen with the Red Sox dumping their contract on the Dodgers and now the Marlins dumping Josh Johnson, Mark Burley, Jose Reyes, Emilio Bonifacio, and John
Buck to the Blue Jays.
To the Blue Jays
for seven.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of prospects, and obviously, you know,
let's
set the stage. It's funny to look on the baseball in the print edition or in the iPad edition of Baseball America. If you go to your Blue Jays top 10, you just go down the left column, numbers 2, 5, and 8 in the Blue Jays' top 10. Number 2, Jake Marisnick. Number 5, I'm already blanking on Justin Nicolino. And number 8, Adani Hechavarria. I was just looking up in an old edition of a Baseball America almanac about Hechavarria. He got a game-winning hit off Nick Mirande in the 16U World Championships, I think. It's the only time in the last 6 years the 16U team lost a game. And with Hechavarria got a base hit, so two big leaguers already. It was like in 2007, so it's pretty funny to go back and look through that. So those three guys, Jeff Mathis and his 2-year contract going from Toronto.
I'm surprised the Marlins were willing to take that.
Yeah, he might be the highest paid Marlin now. And Henderson Alvarez, who had a brutal year, but does have an electric arm. And am I missing anyone else who went from Toronto?
Right-handed
pitcher?
Right-hander, wasn't on the top 30.
Anthony DeSclafani, the former University of Florida.
I wanted you to pronounce it because I know I would pronounce it wrong.
Anthony DeSclafani is a nice, you know, he probably should have been on the Blue Jays top 30, and he'll definitely be on the Marlins top 30. He's an intriguing arm. He's probably a reliever, but you know, I've seen him 96, 97 myself, and it comes out pretty easy. So some intriguing guys. And first off, JJ, I guess we have to start off with, you know, you made some calls on this last night. I didn't work this trade yet, but you did some. And Will Lingo made the same point that you made, and he hadn't talked to you yet this morning when I came in, which is strictly from a baseball sense, just looking at this as a baseball trade, the Marlins didn't do so bad in this trade. They got some talent for talent. They got some talent back in this trade.
I made a couple calls last night, and I had a guy in the game, you know, relatively high up in the game, who I, you know, value his opinion, said, you know what, on the baseball merits, like this for the Marlins. Said, no, the problem with this is it's hard to really evaluate this just on the baseball merits. I talked to someone else.
Yeah, you can't really do it, but let's try to be in the vacuum and just look at it from that aspect.
I'll
first.
Say this. The best way to put this is that when you said that, if you said today the Red Sox announced that they traded and we take this and this was the Red Sox trade that they did when they did with the Dodgers, or if you said that, to pick another team out of the blue, that the Brewers swung this deal, I don't think that the reaction would be the same. I think if that was the case, and with a little bit different circumstances, I think if you then would be able to look at it from the baseball standpoint and say, I don't think this is a great deal for the Marlins on the baseball sense, from the standpoint that you traded the best player in this trade, you traded away.
Right.
The second best player in this trade, you traded away.
Right.
I would say you could probably say the third best player in trade you got back. Like if you're talking about, you know, because all of this works into future ability and all that.
I like Mark Burley better than you, so I would say Burley to me is still the third best player. I would not trade Mark Burley straight up for Jake Marisnik.
With this contract he has, I wouldn't.
Mark Burley's so durable. It's so hard to find pitching these days. And I have enough questions about Jake Marisnik's hit tool that I would take Mark Burley. Right. But it's debatable.
Right, that's debatable. So let's say that's the 3 and 4 in some way. So I'll probably agree with you that you're now going the next player in that is the other one. So you're giving up 3 of the top 4 players in this trade.
Right.
Okay, and if you're saying who's the 5th best player in this trade, Justin Nicolino, is he the 5th best player in this trade?
Probably.
Okay,
probably
so I'll give you the 5th. Bonifacio's
pretty good. I mean, all the guys at the Blue Jays.
Escobar, if it wasn't for the baggage.
But you can't ignore the baggage.
But the baggage is part of it.
The baggage is the reason he's on his 3rd team. I mean, it's hard to find shortstops who are two-way players, and, you know, he's
the Braves were willing to get rid of him when they were basically willing to punt him when they had him as their shortstop of the present and future and go searching for shortstops for years.
So from the baseball standpoint, we think this is a decent trade for the Marlins.
They got some talent back.
I'm just looking at projected lineup for them. You know, you're probably going to have Logan Morrison in one of your corner spots, left or first. You're probably going to have Chris Coughlin. I get his name wrong all the time. You certainly have Giancarlo Stanton, who tweeted out last night that he was displeased, to put it politely.
Yes, he should be.
With his trade. You've got minor league free agent fine, Justin Ruggiano, who's unlikely to reproduce his big year last year,
but he's one of your
cornerstone key guys now.
He is a cornerstone of the team now.
You got Hechavarria and Escobar, who have to be excited about this as Cuban defectors, immigrants, however you want to put it. You have Hechavarria, who I think might have been a Canadian. He might have had Canadian. Well, one of them had. Obviously, Escobar was actually drafted. Hechavarria signed as a free agent, even though he defected in Canada, which I think is kind of a joke. He should have been. I don't know why he wasn't declared, you have to go in the draft. He left in Canada, I'm pretty sure. It's like Jose Iglesias left in Canada, and Noah Lagueyes. That's who I'm confusing him with, and they should have been made subject to the draft.
Escobar is going to be the third baseman. Echevarria will be the shortstop, I would assume.
Or vice versa. But you're guessing these guys are going to be excited to be in Miami. I would imagine. If you know Escobar is going to be good anywhere, it's going to be playing for the Marlins, where he's getting a lot of opportunities. You still have Colombia's Donovan Solano, who's our all-rookie second baseman, playing in the World Baseball Classic qualifier this weekend. We won't forget to talk about that. Or we probably will. Probably won't have time to talk about that. So there's some pieces, but this is a fifth-place lineup. And, JJ, I'm looking at their projected rotation. That's where they're a fifth-place team. Jacob Turner, Nathan Eovaldi, Henderson Alvarez, Ricky Nolasco, Wade LeBlanc.
And Ricky Nolasco, at this point, I'll put it this way, I would not be closing on a house in Miami in the next couple of weeks,
yeah.
Ricky, because you might be next.
Yeah, I mean, with some fifth starter, and then there's not a ton, I mean,
you can,
there's
there,
not
well,
a
you
lot
can
there.
Fill out, you know, and what is going to end up happening is that they're going to be a team that collects several, you know, signed to a minor league contract with an invitation to spring training, because that's the kind of guy they can get now, is the guy who, hey, if my choices are playing for the Marlins and having a chance at a big league job, that guy you can still get. Now, let's say
sometime in 2013, I got to imagine you're going to see both Christian Yelich and Jose Fernandez as their top two prospects. Because
right.
What else do they have to sell?
Well,
what else do they have to market?
But it's
almost like they're going to have, with Fernandez, Hechavarria, and Escobar, 3 Cuban players that are fairly prominent here. I mean, maybe that's
on the baseball
to sell.
Merits. One other thing with that on the baseball merits. What's interesting with this is, in talent's talent, you acquire talent, you figure out the log jams later. They acquire Jake Marisnik. Jake Marisnik's best-selling point is as an athletic center fielder who, you know, who can run,
right,
can play defense, who
they
has
power
superpower,
potential.
And the questions about the hit tool. The Marlins' best position prospect by far, and I think the gulf from him to the second best position prospect, pre-Marisnik, was pretty far.
I don't know. It depends on what you think of Marcell Ozuna. There's some people who like Marcell Ozuna.
I like Marcell Ozuna. I'll put it this way. If you have concerns about Marisnik's hit tool,
right,
double that about
sure.
Marcell Ozuna. But Christian
really
Yelich
good,
was the best, you know, without a doubt, the best position prospect in the organization. Christian Yelich is an athletic center fielder who can run, who can play defense, who can hit for some power and hit for average.
Right. Yeah,
one of those
last
guys.
Podcast, how much we like Christian Yelich.
One of those guys is going to have to move.
Yeah, I don't think that's that big of a problem.
That's
though.
Again, I don't think so either. And I think that I was talking about this on Twitter with people yesterday. I'm JJ Coop 36. He's John Manuel BA on Twitter. we were talking about, I was talking about this on Twitter last night, and I said, I think long-term the Marisnik's going to be the guy who moves, and I had a question, you know, asked us, well, is that because Yelich is better defensively? Not necessarily right now, but if I'm just mapping it out, the reason I say that, and I want to hear your opinion on this, the reason I say I think Yelich is going to end up being the center fielder of the two is for one, there are people who think that Marisnik is more likely to lose his speed as he matures because
he's a bigger guy.
He's a bigger guy. The other is that Marisnik, admittedly, right now, right field's not a problem. But long-term, if Mike Stanton, when he gets expensive and if he gets dealt,
right.
Long-term, Marisnik can be a right fielder. Yelich is a left, center or left. There's no chance of him being a right fielder.
Right.
But the third one is the most important. I know that Marisnik made it to Double-A last year. Yelich didn't. To me, there's no question, though, if you said which guy is closer to the majors, to me it's Yelich. And usually how these things work out, if Yelich comes up and he's your center fielder and he's playing a good center field, and then Marisnik 6 months later is ready to come up, you very rarely go, you know what, you're handling the job, you're doing a great job with it, but we're going to slide you over because we've got this other guy.
I completely agree with everything you said. I think Yelich is more polished. I think he gets to the big leagues first. I think he establishes himself as a, you know, average to a slightly above average defender in center field, which basically means he'll be par for the course. That's what it's like center field and shortstop. Almost. If you're not a plus defender
right,
out
you're
there,
not 60,
you don't
you're
stick
not,
out there.
Yeah.
I don't know that Christian Yelich can be a plus defender in center field. I don't think Jake Marisnik will be either. And so I think you play the guy there who gets there first and establishes that
if he can
hit there. Right, if he can handle it and if he shows that he's hitting there and you don't want to rock the boat, to me that's Christian Yelich. But I agree with everything you said. I think your evaluation of those players is dead on. Now you go to Toronto, JJ, and the American League East has gotten a lot. It just has changed so much in a year from this sameness of the Red Sox and Yankees, with the Rays as this interloper. Now what the Orioles did this year in the regular season, winning 93 games, and now what the Blue Jays have done, Jose Reyes is we've had this discussion all year on the podcast, who's the best shortstop in the American League. If he's healthy in 2013, it better be Jose Reyes. He should be the best shortstop
in
the American League.
And there's not even – unless – the only one I can think of is if something happened to J.J. – you know, the only people I can say could even be in that discussion is if J.J. Harvey has a great year or if Manny Machado ends up playing shortstop.
Well, Elvis Andrus. I mean, if Elvis Andrus continues his offensive progression,
Andrus cannot be the offensive player
Jose. I disagree.
Okay.
Look at Elvis Andrus. He's coming to his man strength.
No, I know he's getting big.
He's like 23 years old. Coming into his man
strength. I follow what you're saying, and I know they have different games, but the reality is that Jose Reyes, if you go back, when Jose Reyes was 19-20 like Elvis Andrus was, he was always better offensively than...
Yeah, I follow you, but Jose Reyes is... he's not on the back end of his career, but he's not... I don't think he's at his peak.
The injuries are a concern.
And I still think that Elvis Andrus, A, he's playing in an offensive ballpark, B, he's playing on an offensive team. I think Elvis Andrus, if he has a year where he had a .350 on base last year and about a .360 slugging, if he just makes that leap, again, in coming into his man strength at age 24, I don't think it's unreal to expect that between ages 24 and 28, this is a guy who starts slugging over 400 consistently and is like a .450 slugging guy by the time it's said and done. He's big.
He's a strong guy. I hear what you're saying there.
He'll never have a peak of what Jose Reyes's peak was offensively. I follow you, but I do think that Elvis Andrus in 2013 has a chance to be a better player than Jose Reyes.
I follow you. So what you're saying, though, is to me, from what I interpret of what you're seeing, what Elvis Andrus could do, you're thinking that Jose Reyes, we've seen the best of him.
Correct.
Because what you just described, if Jose Reyes at his best, is better than that.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely, but I don't think Jose Reyes will ever be that guy again.
Okay.
He's just been too injured. He's just not consistent enough. I would love for him to prove me wrong.
And one of the problems...
At his best, he's an incredibly dynamic and fun-to-watch player. No rooting interest in here. I just want to see I want to see good shortstops. I'm tired of seeing crap shortstops. So I'd like to see Jose Reyes come in the American League and be good Jose Reyes, not disinterested Jose Reyes.
And one of the problems with that, though, is for Jose Reyes, with the injury concerns, one of his biggest assets... is one that you probably have to rein in somewhat because of his injury concerns. His speed, his ability to create havoc on the base pass, is something that you have to kind of say, you know what, we don't want you going out and stealing 65 bases for us.
You just have to pick your spots more intelligently when you're 28, 29, 30. You know, he's 20. He'll be 30 this year. This is his age 30 season coming up. You know, maybe I'm more down on him than I should be, but when you look at his 2011 season, it's the outlier in his career, not the norm. The norm for him is between a 102 and 115 OPS plus. That one year when he won the batting title in the National League, and he had 344. That's the big norm, but that's the big outlier. But to me, the norm is an above-average offensive player and above-average defensive player. If he does that, he's the best shortstop in the American League.
And you hate to say it, but I just think the outlier came in his contract year.
Right, and I just don't think people give Elvis Andrus. I think people are very stuck on the fact that Elvis Andrus had a year where he barely slugged 300 a couple years ago. The last 2 years has gone up to 360 and 379. He's 23, he's going to be 24. He plays every day. He's a great defensive player and a leader.
I'm a fan, too.
Right. To me, this guy's offense is just going to keep getting better. I just think if you look at the guy physically, this is not a guy who's going to keep slugging under 400. He's just too physical for that. And you know, the other guy who might be the best shortstop in the American League is Jurickson Profar. So you just never know. We've already found out in this offseason, less than a month old, that anything can happen.
Right.
And so it's a fun trade to talk about in that regard. Does this trade make the Blue Jays the American League East favorite to you, JJ?
No.
Is that good?
No.
Okay. It doesn't for me either.
By the way, if you want to go back, we were to just the difference of the Blue Jays in a week, though. We were talking about them last week.
Yeah.
And I remember you saying, like, what does this team hang its hat on?
Right.
Well, now they hang their hat on the middle of that lineup. You've got Reyes kind of teeing it up, followed by basically
probably Bonifacio because he's a table setting speed guy.
That's the kind of speed. The reality is that those two guys at the top of the lineup, one of the things it does do is in the AL East. You know, the Yankees are always a team that basically, our catcher needs to hit. You know,
right.
You know, and you know the Red Sox. I don't think you play a lot of catcher for them. The Red Sox are supposedly in on Mike Napoli.
Well, just signed David Ross.
No, I said they said, but they're still on Mike Napoli
after
that.
Right. Oh yeah. No, I know.
So, yeah. But what I'm saying,
Ryan Lavarnway and Jared Saltalamacchi aren't known for their defense either.
Right. What I'm saying is that they now have a kind of a speed component that at least you're going to have to pay attention to a little
bit
more. Then you go, okay, take your pick. Is it Brett Lowry batting, followed by Joey Bats, followed by Encarnacion? Well, we need better out of Lowry than you got last year, no doubt about
that.
But it's there, and that's all of a sudden, that's a very impressive lineup now.
And I'm looking at a projected rotation. Obviously, Josh Johnson's the big question mark here, but that's why Mark Burley is is an excellent compliment to Josh Johnson. He's so durable. He's shown he can win in the American League. I love Mark Burley. I mean, I just think he's underrated because he doesn't throw hard. Every year, this guy is 200 innings, efficient, and obviously has a perfect game to his name. Has been a frontline starter on a World Series championship team, although that was now almost 8 years ago with the White Sox in 2005. But he's still steady. He's not a one or a two guy, but he's an excellent compliment to Josh Johnson. I bet you he's a positive influence on Ricky Romero. And don't forget the complete X factor in all this. Beyond Johnson is Brandon Morrow, who's got big-time stuff. He's got number one stuff. I was just talking to a scout yesterday about we were having this debate again, Brandon Morrow, Tim Lincecum. I was like, hey, look, everybody, all 30 clubs, if they had to do that decision over again, would do Lincecum over Morrow. He was still arguing that Morrow long-term will be worth more. I think he's crazy.
The problem is you can't – Tim Lincecum has already put those Cy Youngs in the bank.
5 years from now, Tim Lincecum could be done, and Brandon Morrow could be winning two Cy Youngs. That's possible. I don't put that past Brandon Morrow,
but
I still think every team would do it over again. Would do Lincecum.
I'll take the $2 million in the bank
and the two World Series championships.
Over the promise of, and two World Series championships.
Yes.
Over the promise of the potential of $5 million down the road. Give me the $2
million. Respect that evaluator quite a bit, but that was a pretty funny discussion to have. But the point is that Brandon Morrow is really good. When he's at his best, Brandon Morrow is a number one starter in terms of stuff, and that's hard to find.
The interesting thing about this also, though, this does change the dynamic for the Blue Jays going forward, too, in that their farm system, I think we both are not anti-Blue Jays farm system, but we're not as high on it as some other people are.
Yeah, it's just not a great – right now their top 10 includes Daniel Norris, Matt Smorl, and Anthony Alford. So Daniel Norris, who had a horrific year in the Appy League this year.
Terrible.
Matt Smorrell, who pitched twice all spring and had a broken foot. It is interesting. And he's a top 10 talent, mm-hmm. but there's a lot of
projection to go.
Tons of projection, a lot of uncertainty there. But I will say I like the recent track record of high school pitchers out of Ohio. I'm looking at you, Jonathan Neese, and the big fat guy for the Chad Billingsley for the Dodgers. I couldn't think of him. Okay, he's just big boned. And then number 10 is Anthony Alford, who's playing quarterback for Southern Miss. I mean, there's a lot of there's upside in that farm system, but there's a lot of questions.
Go above that. The other thing with it is that now that you take basically Mariznick out of it and you take Echevarri out of it, there is no – Travis d'Arnaud is the only guy in their top 10 who basically has any significant time above A-ball.
Correct. Yeah, the rest of their farm system at the top levels are a little iffy.
And so, but the thing that this changes is now some of those guys may end up being trade chips this year because they do.
Yeah, now you're all in.
Now you're all in. And if you come to June, come to July, I think before this trade, if the Blue Jays came to June, July, and they were doing fairly well, but not great, and they're in third place in the East, and you say,
right.
You know what, we're not gonna gut our top pitching prospects to make a push. I think now that you put that same scenario, you say, yeah, we do.
Absolutely do. Now you're in a win in 2013 mode. It just shifted their entire organization's philosophy from like a more of a longer term, a bigger picture, longer term look to a shorter term look. And John Farrell has to be the guy who's kind of wondering, wait a minute, what did I just leave behind? As he leaves Toronto to go be the Red Sox manager, he just went from a franchise that was on the upswing to one that's kind of in decline. And
I think right now if you said, okay, you asked that question to me. Okay, so who is your favorite? I think it still has to be as bad as they looked in the playoffs. I think the Yankees are still the favorite.
I agree. We'll see what happens this offseason, obviously. I think we don't know.
Right.
They're going to have to probably replace Nick Swisher. But I still think the Yankees have one more year to wring out of them before that group, as presently assembled, is done for. Especially because I still think they're starting pitching. I still think CeCe Sabathia, I know a couple years from now this guy's contract is going to be a millstone for them. But Sabathia, I still like Ivan Nova, Phil Hughes. I still think the rotation looks pretty good, even without Kuroda. They have obviously the financial wherewithal to improve their roster if they need to do it.
Right. I think the Yankees are at the top. I still think we don't know what's going to happen in the offseason. But right now,
I'd say Toronto's second for me. I think Tampa has some pretty big holes there. And I know that Ben Zobrist is a really good player. First of all, they have to fill their center field or an outfield spot.
Right.
I know they intend to move Desmond Jennings over. But, Desmond Jennings hasn't done it yet. B.J. Upton did it. They still have to find a corner bat, first base, left field, kind of DH. They really don't have one.
And please, at some point, I know Jose Molina's good at framing, and I know they've had some guys who can pick it at short.
Right.
But, shortstop and catcher.
And Ben Zobrist is 32. If memory serves, he's at 32. He might even be 33 years old. This guy was he was either a fourth year junior or a senior or a fifth year senior. He was old. He was 23 when he made his pro debut in the minor leagues. Ben Zobrist is a very good player. Kudos to Dave Cameron and the Fangraphs guys for pointing out first that Ben Zobrist wasn't just good. He was really a great player. They were right. He's had a great career. But he just finished his age 31 season. This guy's going to start declining soon, especially if you keep asking more and more out of him playing shortstop.
But that being said,
to me, I would take the Blue Jays over Tampa pitching, be damned. We'll see what happens.
I was going to say, and all right now, like I said, and this could change because we don't know who they're – someone's getting dealt. But I'll still take – because there's still enough questions there. Because with the Blue Jays, you're talking, okay, will Josh Johnson be the Josh Johnson, the good Josh Johnson,
right,
or the banged-up Josh Johnson?
But the
Johnson?
Rays had all that pitching this year and didn't make the playoffs, and American League East was wide open, and they didn't get it done.
But they still were.
They were good.
I'm
not saying they weren't good.
And I don't think their pitching is going to be any worse next year significantly.
I don't either, but I don't think Fernando Rodney will be that good. So, A, I think it's unlikely that he will repeat his miraculous 2012 season. And all these offensive questions are still there to be answered, and as we discussed last week.
And they don't have
internal answers. They're going to have to make that pitching trade, and they very well could. But it looks like to do that, you have to take on some salary. Are they going to do that? Every other trade that when you make your team better involves taking on some salary. They have shown zero willingness.
The best answer is the best I can give you on that is it's an incomplete, because right now we know what the Blue Jays have done.
Right, and that's why given the choice right now, I'd take the Blue Jays over the Rays. I mean, and I understand the Rays have more strength. We'll wrap this topic with, did you read Keith Olbermann's blog post about this?
No, I've not seen that yet.
Keith Olbermann basically wrote that this is, in his mind, long term, what this trade signifies, everyone agrees, this poisons the Miami market, despite the new ballpark, that Jeffrey Loria is indefensible as an owner. He's ruined one market in Montreal, which had its own problems, but he drove a stake through its heart. And now in Miami, another market that had its problems, but he, again, drove a stake through its heart with this trade and the way he built the taxpayers for that ballpark. Olbermann's point was, not only will this ruin the Miami market, but this will eventually just ruin Florida for all of for Major League Baseball, because what can the Rays do? How are the Rays going to be able to go to the public there in the Tampa area in a state that still has basically an economic depression in Florida, a state that has so many problems, and then you just have one market that built the taxpayers out of a ballpark, built it, and then gutted the team. What do the Rays ever do to stay there? How do the Rays stay there long-term?
One thing I will say with this, and I think I've said this on the podcast before, I don't disagree with most of those points. And I do think before we move on, we have to talk about the non-baseball part of this.
I do think it's intriguing. I don't necessarily agree with Keith, but I think it's intriguing, thought-provoking.
The one thing I think, though, that foundation of that is built on kind of shaky ground is that the Florida baseball market has always, and I believe will always, be terrible. I don't think that's... the one part of this, and I'm sorry, Jeffrey Loria does not deserve any, kudos or any I'll pat you on the back.
We're not trying to be soft on him. I got
you. They didn't sell out every game last year. Here's the thing. I don't care. You could build the baseball version of Jerry World, the Cowboys Stadium, and you could put it anywhere you want, exactly in the spot you want in Florida. I don't think you're drawing that much.
You could have done it for the Dolphins, who are the only team there with any tradition.
I don't think you're drawing that much. It is a bad
sports market
if you're talking about fans going out to games. I don't think, yes, the ballpark in Tampa, bad ballpark.
Worst ballpark in the majors except for maybe the A's.
No doubt. That being said, they could be playing in Camden Yards. They wouldn't be drawing.
I agree.
And the reality of that is that what it comes down to is that, and so, yes, you're right. This is going to nuke the possibility of the Rays ever getting a ballpark in the Tampa-St. Pete area, a new ballpark.
It's pretty nuclear.
But that's actually probably good for the taxpayer in Tampa, and it may be good long-term for the Rays, because the reality of it is that they could have built that ballpark, and they're not going to draw 30,000 on an average.
Right. They're not.
They're going to draw 30 when the Yankees come to town, because the reality of this is that there's a couple things. One, it's a very seasonal. A lot of these communities, half the community's gone during baseball season.
Right. Put it this way, they've even tried more cowbell, and that hasn't worked in Tampa. I mean, they've tried everything.
Now I want to get on the part that doesn't excuse Jeffrey Loria, because
it does not.
What he did here, the reality is that I've seen on Twitter a couple people try to make the argument, hey, they're just following the Billy Bean approach, that says that if you're going to be middle of the pack, tear it apart.
Never middle of the pack.
But the problem with that is this: to do that, I think that you can have an intelligent fan can understand with a smaller market team. Which I'm sorry, you're in Miami. I don't even know if I buy this that this is a smaller market. But I can understand the argument that if you're a team that's less financial resources, partly because the owner is pocketing a whole lot of money, but less financial resources, you're going to have cycles where you build up, you make your run for it, and then at some point you have to tear that down and start over. But the intelligent fan who can understand that, there has to be part of the cycle. The cycle can't be that you tried for 2 months and then you started tearing it down and we'll try again in 5 years. And that's what the Marlins essentially... Right. The best that they can try to sell that is, hey, We went out and signed Reyes. We signed Heath Bell. We signed, you know, we had Hanley Ramirez. We had Stanton coming up. And you know what? We tried it in April.
Right.
And in
for
2 weeks. And in May, we kind of decided it wasn't working too well because Heath Bell was blowing some saves.
Right.
And by June, we were sellers.
The thing is, I think in June, though, they did pick up Carlos Lee. I think that's when they traded for
right,
Carlos Lee, which is kind of inexplicable in hindsight. At least they did try. It just there's no defense of Jeffrey Loria. I will. And I also have to say, JJ, I don't see how people who work for the Marlins and who've worked for Jeffrey Loria for a long time can do it with a straight face. I don't see how, or if you work for David Sampson, I don't see how Michael Hill, their executive VP, their general manager, can do it. I don't see how Stan Meek, their longtime scouting director, can do it. I don't see how Dan Jennings, their assistant GM, can do it. I know these guys have big contracts that have been locked up with the Marlins. I understand that. I know the industry has a lot of, you know, it's very hard to keep a job long-term, and there's a lot of instability in the industry. So when you have that opportunity to sign that contract, you do it. But how do you keep working for this guy? Because he's a liar. He's a liar, John, as Alan Matthews once famously said. I mean, he and David Sampson, they just lie to the taxpayers. They lie to the ticket buyers, their ticket base. It must be very difficult to be a Marlins employee today, and I feel bad for those guys.
The problem is that
I really feel bad for those guys. All their area scouts, managers in their minor leagues, or coaches.
And
I feel for those guys because
and that's one of the things we need to make clear here.
Control.
That's one of the things we need to make clear here is that this is not a team built to say, you know what, the next wave is a year away, and then we're gonna. They have two guys in their farm system who we both love.
Yeah. Those are
Jose
two top,
Fernandez
like,
and Christian Yelich
are top 20 farm guys. Top 10 and top 20.
Yeah. Fernandez is the top 10 guy.
No
Yelich
doubt.
Is the top 20 guy. Those two guys.
Fernandez might be like the number two pitching prospect in the whole minors.
Right. Those two guys, you can't. It's hard to find guys. You can find them, but it's hard to find them
if you're talking
who don't
best,
love them.
If you're talking best pure hitter in the minors, I'd say Taveras is one.
And I'd say Yelich.
But Yelich is in the conversation
for two.
He's
in the conversation for two.
Just off the top. I mean, that's elite. Those are two elite.
And they have. And beyond that, Marcelo Zuna has as much. If everything comes together, Marcelo Zuna is Mike Stanton-like.
He's
got as much power, but he's not. I mean, the reality is that he doesn't have the same feel and all where I could say that he's going to become Mike Stanton. But
he's just not as athletic.
He could become a lesser version of Mike Stanton. But
you got Andrew Heaney, their 2012 first-round pick. I think he's a future 2-3 starter. I mean, he's good. I mean, he is legit. I really like Andrew
Heaney. But the reality of it is that you start running out of guys pretty quick.
Yeah, I mean.
I like JT Realmuto more than most, and the reality is that he's probably going to get a chance to catch in the big leagues now before too long. You know. But
don't you like Kyle Jensen a little bit?
A little bit, but Kyle Jensen I know he's having a very good AFL. That's one of those things where I don't get too excited about the nice AFL he's having because I'm probably more inclined to go, well, maybe he's figured some things out, but that was not a very good 2012 over 140 games against better pitching that he's facing now.
We all know that Jim Callis used to love Zach Cox more than most. I don't think he loves Zach Cox as much as he used to, but now they acquired him from the Cardinals. So, I mean, there are some pieces there, but yeah, it's just ugly. I'd hate to work for that organization. It would have to be disheartening. Not just a fan. Think about if you're a fan, there's one thing. There are not that many fans. But if you work for the organization, you put in all this work to win championships.
And that's what you're there to do.
That's what you're there to do.
Yeah,
now you see that you have no chance of that with current ownership.
The reality
that's
is
tough.
That the best way I can put it is that the job, I know everyone wants to, you know, so many people want to work in baseball and how great. But the reality is the job is too tough to do just to collect a check.
Yeah, it is too hard. I agree. I mean, Baseball America podcast with John and JJ. Good stuff on the trade. And also want to remind people that if it's our Tim Collins, one of our IT guys, El Señor Bueno.
On Twitter.
On Twitter reminds you that if you haven't already checked it out, the second iteration of Baseball America's free agent tracker, minor league free agent tracker, is on there. And as I wrote last month, I like this column, so I'm going to keep talking about it. For two glorious issues, JJ, I had a nice column streak going with the Madison, AJ Griffin. Then, of course, I crashed it last issue. But the Madison Griffin column, and then not Madison Griffin, Brian
Mattis
and AJ
Griffin.
And then I always like that Mattis and Bumgarner column I did because it sounds like Madison Bumgarner. Anyway, that was another good. When I write a column about Brian Mattis, it usually turns out pretty well. But then I also wrote this one about minor league free agents. Gregor Blanco was on this list last year. Donde Está Blanco, he was on this list last year. And then Joaquin Arias was on this list last year. So our minor league free agent tracker, check it out. It's at baseballamerica.com. What is it? Actually, I don't even have the URL in front of me. But
baseballamerica.com. It's going to be – well, before long, when we get off this podcast, when I have time, it's going to be a permanent link on the front page just under the – we have right now the schedule for the 2013 top tens. Right there on the very prominently on the front page, just under the top little rotating thing,
okay.
It's going to have a link to the minor league free agent tracker.
But we'll also retweet this, so you should favorite that tweet so you can go back and find it. Because we understand sometimes it can be hard to find things on baseballamerica.com.
We're working on that.
We're working on it. But you can see the guy's new organization when they sign, if they have been in our handbook ever. So those might be older scouting reports, but you get an idea what kind of player they are. If they've ever been in a best tool survey, they're on there. So kudos to Matt Eddy.
I'm not joking when I say
guys.
This. You could spend, if you wanted to, you could spend 20 hours on that easy.
So that's good stuff. We got a lot of good stuff on Baseball America.
Today, if you're listening to this podcast, you've got analysis, the complete analysis. If you enjoyed this about the top 10, the trade, you can listen.
Yeah, Matt Eddy's trade.
Matt Eddy has a complete trade analysis of it. We have a scouting report on Dodgers' new acquisition, the one that they won the posting fee for, Korean left-hander Hun Jin Ryu. And so a very detailed scouting report with video of him from Korea.
I'll try to say his name. I believe it's Yu Hyun Jin, if you pronounce it Korean fashion. I listened to it. Yeah. I hope I remember it. Not just scouting reports from the 2008 Olympics and 2009 World Baseball Classic, where Yu was a huge part of Korea winning the gold medal in 2008, and they had the best record in the 2009 WBC. Remember, they had the perfect run until they lost in the semifinals.
We'll also tweet it again because we love to. We'll tweet out his him being on the
2009 WBC top 10 prospects list, which was 1, Darvish, 2,
Chapman,
3 was Iwakuma because we had a man crush on Hisashi Iwakuma.
He ended up having a very good year.
He did.
He had in Seattle this year.
Number 4 is Tanaka, the pitcher's name.
Yeah,
Ryan, a pitcher
for
Japan.
Still in
who's
Japan.
Great.
Gold Samurai winner in 2011.
Number 5 was Yu. Number 6, Yoenis Céspedes.
We're a little low on him, to be honest.
Number 7, Noriichi Aoki of the Brewers, who had a great year in the major leagues this year. So
number 8, Yulesky Gurriel, who will probably never come.
We feel pretty good about that top 7. We feel pretty good about that
even Gurriel.
Top 7.
Like, if Gurriel came over right now.
Oh, yeah. No, he'd get a lot of money.
He'd get a lot of money. It's just that he's probably not going to come over, but we did say when we did
he's
it,
only coming
we're not ranking Cubans on the likelihood of them coming over.
I don't want to get political here too much, but I do think in the wake of last week's election and in the wake of what's happening in Cuba, I think it is possible in the next 3 to 4 years, especially if Marco Rubio is the next guy out of the Republican Party, I think it's very possible that President Obama and his administration changes significantly American policy.
Well, let me ask you this.
If it were just opened up,
I think he would be the number.
It'd be so exciting.
But he would be the number 2 prospect coming out of who's left in Cuba right now.
I think he'd actually still be number 1 over Despaigne because Despaigne is a 5'9" right-handed hitting right fielder.
That may be true.
Alfredo Despaigne could be a Kirby Puckett type with more power, I suppose, and a better eyesight, and hopefully better deportment around women. But Alfredo Despaigne, it's hard to know. It's like basically in Cuba, they're kind of playing with the summer collegiate ball these days. I mean, JJ, they've broken – I just was editing this for the Almanac. The 2011-2012 Cuba Serie Nacional, we could segue from this into the World Baseball Classic if you want. But Alfredo Despaigne broke – it was the fifth time in the last 4 years the home single-season home run record has been broken in Cuba. It happened with both guys this year, José Darriel Abreu and – Alfredo Despaigne, and Despaigne broke the record on the last day of the regular season this year with an inside-the-park home run, which you can't even say you lost in the lights because half the stadiums in Cuba don't even have lights anymore. So it's just pitiful. Did you know that Cuba's Serie Nacional expanded last year? They essentially took the Yankee. They took La Havana, and they broke it into 2 teams. That's kind of crazy, but I digress.
We have some questions.
Take some Twitter questions, and then we could either go AL. We probably should just go ahead.
We'll do another
WBC, and we'll do an AL Central separately, exactly.
And we may have to do 2 AL Central.
I appreciate that we're on the same page.
Alec Dopp, A-L-E-C-D-O-P-P on Twitter, asks, what's your take on Taylor Youngman?
I hadn't even seen that one. He must have just asked that to you.
Just to me.
You know, Taylor Youngman, first of all, Captain Headwack.
I don't worry about throwing it to you blind. I know you can answer it.
He's Captain Headwack in college. Always enjoyed the headwack.
Describe a headwack to someone who does not.
Just pick disco YouTube Max Scherzer and watch his delivery, and that picture's a headwack. At the end of his delivery, instead of all his direction continuing toward home plate, his head, and therefore the body follows, whacks or jerks to the side, usually to the left side, and he's kind of getting his head out of the way of his body, essentially, and it makes it harder to repeat your delivery, harder to command the fastball, harder to command all your pitches, because there's a little extra effort and violence in your delivery. So Taylor Youngman has smoothed that out a little bit, but, you know, to me, Taylor Youngman, I thought as a freshman in Omaha in 2009, he was Texas' ace. He threw quite hard. He was regularly in the mid-90s against LSU that year. I think Aaron Fitt and I both thought Taylor Youngman had a future front of the rotation possibilities. He's kind of evolved from that. Maybe I shouldn't say devolved, but he's evolved from that into a guy who's a little bit more of a command-oriented sinker, life on the fastball, and commanding the fastball, as opposed to a guy with big-time stuff, JJ. But it sounds like he really made progress in the Florida State League this year, and he sounds like he's a 3-4 starter type for the Brewers, potentially, down the line if it all works out.
Right.
More of a fourth starter for you, I think.
I think a fourth starter, fourth. I think there are some concerns that the stuff is not. I mean, if you see him on a bad night, the stuff's pretty pedestrian. Is the concern now?
He seems like he's a skinny guy. He's really never filled out physically in terms of he's just never gotten a lot
thicker.
He's
one of the guys. The best way to put it is that when you say, I think it is there. You can call it devolving or whatever you want. He's learned how to pitch with what he has.
Yeah,
but I don't think I'll put it this way. It's not like, hey, I'm going to pull back a little bit on this so I can locate better. This is what I got now. The best stuff in Taylor Youngman's career seems like we've already seen it.
I think he left it at Rosenblatt Stadium.
Right, and the thing that concerns you with that is
moment
that
of silence for Rosenblatt Stadium. All right, sorry.
But the thing that concerns you with that is that, okay, for one, is his stuff that we see now, is it going to maintain or is it going to keep going that direction?
That's an important question.
That's a concern.
He has lost margin for error that when he pitched once a week in Texas that he had. He does not have that
so
as
if
a
there, professional. If he loses another tick off the fastball, well, you know, the reality is there's just not – at that point, then he becomes one of 1,000 pitchers out there.
But he does have angle.
He does have
life on his stuff.
He does have an understanding.
Well.
I'll put it this way. You see enough there to where you say, okay, yes. Is he a prospect? Absolutely. Is he the prospect – if he was not a first-round pick last year, would you probably think of him the way you do? If he didn't have the track record he had at Texas, probably not. If you came in completely cold on this guy and said, you know what, as a scout, said, I'm going to sit on this guy for his next 5 starts, you would probably leave those 5 starts. Again, taking all past track record out of it and say 4 or 5.
Right.
And that's the thing is that when he's projected 3-4, that projection comes from, well, you know what? Even if you rewound to the start of 2011 when he went on a great, you know, stretch at Texas, you're going back to that and you're saying, we know that's there.
Right.
Will he get that back? Was it adjusting to the first year of pitching every fifth day?
I do think that he has a knack for pitching. Mm-hmm. I do think that he has just shown a lot of moxie, a lot of savvy in his career where he knows how to make a pitch when he needs to make a pitch. He knows how to win a game when he needs to win a game. I'm not saying he's Jack Morris. I'm not going to that kind of crazy extreme. I'm realistic about his ceiling. I do think if he's a forced starter guy, I'm confident that he'll get to his ceiling while at the same time acknowledging that his ceiling is less than he used to be.
The best hope with him, if you wanted to put the rosiest of glasses on for this, is that next year, you know, he has a full off season. He's gotten through his first. He got through relatively healthy his first full season of pro ball. Next year, if the stuff bounces back up a little bit, you know, if you say, "Hey, you really worked out hard in the off season."
The Brewers are so well known for their ability to develop.
Yeah, that's that's another concern. But if you said the rosiest of scenarios. He's learned to pitch even more because his stuff backed up a little bit.
Right.
You add the stuff back. Well, then you're really talking something. But the reality is that if you gave me what chances of that happening, I'll give it 5 to 10%.
I'm going to give you Carlos Slim on that.
You know, I won't break it down into the tenths of decimal percentages, but it's not good.
JJ, the other Twitter question that I have in here is from Mo Colton, Mo Problems. is there anything legitimately wrong with Brett Lowry, particularly from a power perspective? I would say not being – hashtag not a scout, the answer is no. I do think he's a little – every young player – not every, but most young players don't make it look as easy as Bryce Harper and Mike Trout did. They
most
go through,
players aren't that good.
Yeah, and Brett Lowry's not that good. Let's face it. Brett Lowry's not as good as those guys.
No, and the best way I can put it is, you know, I've been here now 10 years. You've been here for
16.
Yeah. And I would
– hashtag old.
And I would say – we've seen a lot of great players come through, a lot of great prospects make the big leagues. I think the two best we've seen in our at least in my time here, two best position prospects I've seen come through, if you said who are the best players that's going to be the best players when you look back 20, 30 years from now, Mike Trout, Bryce Harper.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think. Like, I started September of 96. I don't think there's been anybody. I mean, like, you know, A-Rod was already in the major leagues by the time I started here. I mean, Jeter was already in the major leagues by the time I started here. I mean, I do remember going to watch Rick Ankiel with the same sense of awe and wonder in the minor leagues that I had
right. Watching
the other
guys.
Talk pitching, that was when he was pitching.
If you talk pitching, then there's a chance, because I would say if he stays healthy, which, hey, he was in Clayston Glass this year, so maybe it helped.
Yeah, Strasburg.
The Strasburg stuff is in that same level. Like, that's first – that.
Yeah,
if you
I'll
said
never
the
forget.
Most enjoyable thing – I mean – and, you know,
correct.
The first big league start Steven Strasburg had was just...
That was about as fun a moment as we've ever had at Baseball America. That was just awesome. And again, you know, for me, moments. I won't even get into those. But, yes, from a prospect standpoint, I think you're right. I think Trout and Harper are the best.
But,
and
sorry, so, Brett Lowry's not...
Brett Lowry's not in their class, but I do think Brett Lowry, you know, I do think Brett Lowry's going to be an above-average major leaguer. I think he's going to be a 280 to 300 hitter with 25 home runs at his peak. Will he do that in 2013? I'm not sure. I think he still has to learn that line of aggressiveness and getting into hitters' counts. But that doesn't happen automatically for a lot of hitters. So
I
would say be patient with him. This guy sped to the minor leagues. I do think it's more likely to happen now with Jose Reyes and these guys. We talked about it during the AL East podcast. The Jays so much still hinges on their left-handed hitters, guys like Colby Rasmus and Adam Lind and maybe, I suppose, potentially David Cooper, slotting in around these right-handed power bats they have in Lowry, Batista, and Encarnacion. So you got to have some balance.
I do think that this move helps them. This move helps him from the standpoint that when we were talking about last week,
yeah,
we were saying that they really had to rely on Brett Lowry. Brett Lowry doesn't come through next year, they're in trouble.
We were saying, what is the identity of this franchise? And in part, it was, hey, we've got the best Canadian, and we're Canada's team. Oh, Canada. You know, now that's not the identity of their team.
Now, if you say, how important is Brett Lowry going to be in their lineup? Well, the reality is if he's the fifth best hitter in their lineup, they could be okay now. And you couldn't say that before. But now,
if
you
said,
you know, well, Reyes is better than him. He should be. You know, Batista's better than him.
Sure, Batista and Encarnacion.
They're better than him. And then you could say, you know what, if he ends up being that next year Bonifacio's better than him, and he's the...
I did not realize the depth of your Emilio Bonifacio fandom, but that's all right. I don't disagree. You must have sat next to Jack McKeon at a hot stove. Trader Jack loved him.
In an elevator recently.
He loves some Emilio Bonifacio.
I rode the elevator with him in Greensboro earlier this year to watch Jose Fernandez. So.
That's it. Do you want to talk World Baseball Classic qualifiers at all? They start tonight/tomorrow.
I hate to say it, but I think we're both in the same on this. These qualifiers, I wish I could – I don't have the fever for these qualifiers because the rosters, there will be some interesting moments and all, but these rosters, just this is the part where you go, you know what? I like what they're doing. I like how they're expanding it.
Yeah.
I do. The reality is right now we're about six teams too many in this.
I wish that there were a little bit more compelling storylines in the one in Panama. I do think the Panamanian qualifiers would be very interesting. You have Panama, Brazil, Colombia, and Nicaragua. I always enjoyed as a child. I'm sure you did, too, seeing the guy, whoever the reporter was for CBS News I used to watch, who would always be reporting for Managua, Nicaragua. So that word is always in my head. But to me, like, Nicaragua, Panama, Colombia, Brazil just don't quite have enough compelling storylines. I do think that would be a very competitive WBC.
Right,
if all these games are streaming
online. But none of those teams have a chance to me to – I mean, their whole goal
has a shot.
No, I'm saying their whole goal to me is to get in, and then they might win a couple of games, but I don't see any of these teams advancing.
Panama has a small shot. Panama does have First of all, Panama's compelling in that it has Ruben Rivera playing. Which yeah. I just
39-year-old
awesome.
Ruben Rivera.
Hide your gloves. Make sure you write your name on your glove, Carlos Lee. I'm sure Carlos Lee's not going to really be carrying a glove there. But I'm disappointed that Ramiro Mendoza, I don't believe, is on the Panamanian roster. Fernando Seganal, an all-time personal cheese ball, is not on there. I saw Fernando Seganal hit a long homer in a Dodger Stadium in 2000. So Fernando Seganal, not on the roster. Panama has some prospects. You do the Colombian team has some of their young prospects. You do have Corn Island's own Chesler Cuthbert on the Nicaragua lineup, but and Brazil, you know, Brazil's interesting. If you don't know, Brazil has a lot of ethnic Japanese who live in Brazil, work in the auto industry in Brazil. And I remember going to the Pan Am Games many moons ago in 1999 and being stunned that Brazil's team was all Japanese.
Well, now it's
a little bit more of a mix, and you do have Rienzo, Jan Gomes, you have Andre Rienzo of the White Sox.
Paulo Orlando will be able to field, you know, he'll be able to pick it a little bit in the
right,
outfield.
Right, he's a AAA player, so it's interesting. I think it would be great for Major League Baseball and for baseball, capital B baseball, if Brazil did well in the WBC, because that would be a great market to see baseball grow in. But the so I think that'll be a very competitive WBC, and if you have WBC FIVA, I would stream those games because I think that'll be a very competitive qualifier.
If the Chinese Taipei Taiwan, whichever you want to call them, if they do not advance out of the Asia qualifier,
that'd be the biggest stunner in international baseball history.
Because the reality is that we said this before on the podcast, they're the team in this that stands out. Like the two that stood out to me, like, you know what? If there are two teams who got jobbed in all this,
yeah,
Canada and Taiwan/Chinese Taipei.
Absolutely.
I mean, because those are the two you say, those are legitimately, for one, they try.
Right.
These are not teams.
These are baseball countries.
These are baseball countries who in international baseball, they've had moments.
Yes.
They haven't, this is not picking on Brazil, Panama. The reality is that in the international baseball world, Canada has a better track record than, you know, the Dominican Republic, Venezuela, they're going to be, yes, they get the automatic in, and I may and understand.
Right.
International baseball-wise, Canada has a better...
It's not close. It's not close in recent years. You know, the thing is, Venezuela has a pretty good track record at the amateur level. It just hasn't gotten its act together at the professional level. The Dominican, to my knowledge, has won one international tournament ever. That was the 2010 World Cup qualifying tournament where Bartolo Colon...
The Netherlands has a better track record as far as international
baseball.
Now it does.
Yeah, exactly. Now it does. So... It is. It's fascinating that Taiwan has to go through this qualifier round, but they didn't win a game in the 2009 WBC. They lost even to China, and that's why they're in this knockout round, this qualifier round. But obviously the story here is that the Philippines, Thailand, and New Zealand. New Zealand has the best nickname in all of international baseball, the Diamond Blacks, which is an awesome nickname.
And they do a haka before the game.
Which is nice. You have the two Red Sox Marinara brothers. I'm sure I didn't pronounce the name right, but I'm pronouncing it so that you don't have to.
Thank you.
Andy Skiles of the Giants managing there. You have some interesting managers in this tournament. Barry Larkin managing Brazil.
Not have many
Eduardo
players.
Perez managing. Is he managing Panama or Colombia? I think he's managing Colombia. But yeah, you don't have many interesting players. Thailand, of course, the most interesting story there is Johnny Damon playing for Thailand, which is kind of shocking, really. I had no idea. Johnny Damon's mother was of Thai ethnicity. But he's playing for Thailand. Gino Espinelli, who pitched in the big leagues with the Giants, is playing for the Philippines. But the Philippines did not get Tim Lincecum, who apparently has Filipino descent, did not get Ricky Oropeza of the Giants to play for them. So that could have been a more intriguing qualifier to watch. But as it is, really not didn't float either of our boats. Those games are all streamed at worldbaseballclassic.com. 15th to the 19th is when those tournaments are scheduled, so you can get your international fix if you need it.
I do have one more question that went, I guess, just
to
me.
And we'll wrap here,
We'll wrap here, but this was a good one to kind of end it on because we've had this discussion already many a time in the office. Masterbase on Twitter asks, so where do the Royals and Montgomery go from here? How do you know with that? Because that's a...
Okay, well, that was a big bone of contention last year was Mike Montgomery. I think I was driving the Mike Montgomery bandwagon, and then you kicked me off of it last year and took the reins.
And I'm off of it somewhat. I mean, I want to stay on it somewhat. I don't think you just say, okay, well, give up on him or anything like that. He has to be protected for the Rule 5 this year. To me, if you're the Royals, you have to protect him for the Rule 5. You don't give up on an arm like that, the potential of an arm like that.
What kind of arm is he today, though? That's the question. How are you grading his pitches
right now? I would say
average 2012 Mike Montgomery was what?
I would say 50-55 fastball on an average start. You saw better than that. You saw worse than that. Average start, I'd say 50-55 fastball, 60-65 changeup, 30-35 breaking ball, depending on the night.
Right.
And with 30 command. I mean, that's really, if you said present, not projection, what you're seeing present and what you saw as a guy who did not trust his stuff, I don't think, particularly.
How'd the command get that bad? He's never been a precision guy, but how'd the command get that bad, JJ? What happened?
I think partly, I mean, the thing that concerns me with this is that if you said project out Mike Montgomery, and we were talking about this, you know, me and John have, you know, not on podcast. The thing that concerns me is I can't find anyone. If I found anyone who said, here's what's going wrong with Mike Montgomery and here's how I can fix it, or here's how I think they could fix it, that would, to me, encourage me significantly.
That would make you feel better, yeah.
But I don't find anyone who says, yeah, he's doing this. I think that what's, you know, to put it all, to wrap a bow on it, I think a couple things happened. One, his command never was great, and that was really kind of going to be the separator. If you said the Mike Montgomery to-do list 2 years ago,
yeah.
When 2 years ago, spring training, he was on the edge of being what was viewed as big league ready.
Yeah, when you saw him in Wilmington him as good as you're ever going to see him.
I mean, at that point, if you graded his pitches that night, here's the crazy thing. If you said that night, it would say 70 fastball, 70 changeup. And that night, which admittedly is about as good, that was the best he's ever been, 60-65 breaking ball, which... Maybe if you want to be really hard grader on it, because I said I had a scout that night tell me, you're seeing multiple 70s here, everything's plus. But if you wanted to be a hard grader, maybe you say 55 breaking ball, because you say, you know what, that breaking ball's really good here, but it won't work as well in the big leagues. I could buy that. The changeup in the fastball, it was a 95-mile-an-hour fastball from the left side.
Right, with a crazy
location
good changeup.
And a crazy good changeup. I mean, he got strikeouts of all. Okay, that was his absolute best start. Everyone has a, you know. But if you said what he was in spring training, because in spring training, I think it was going into the 2011 season, he pitched really well, and there was some talk, okay, will this guy be a big leaguer? You know, how far is he away? From there to now, if you said what's happened, one, the to-do list at the time was improve your command, refine your breaking ball.
Refine, but especially the fastball command, because he's always had, since he got out of A-ball, the walk rate has been close to 4. For 9 innings. That seems like that's the number one issue.
And it's control and command, but especially the command in that he got up to AAA, and, you know, the reality is his guys don't chase as much. I mean, that's always true.
Right.
And it got to the point where he was not able, he was getting in bad counts a lot. And I think at that point it spiraled, you know. And the reality is that the Royals have tried to do some things. You know, one thing they did do is there was a, you know, there used to be a pretty big, you know, kind of fight between, I mean, there's no way to put it,
right.
But he wanted to long toss a lot. They told him, you know, we don't want you to long toss. At some point, they basically said, you know what, we're going to let you do what you do. That didn't help. And the reality is that, I mean, he's not, the velocity is not consistently what it was.
That's the biggest question to me. It makes me think there's some kind of injury there.
To me, the one thing I'll say is, because I've wondered about that, the reality is you can kind of, he had a forearm strain a couple of years ago, and you could say that he has not been the same guy since. I've asked Royals people directly, hey, you know, post Danny Duffy, TJ, it came out, well, we knew he had a tear in his ligament, you know, and I've been told it's clean. There's not, to me, that the funny thing is I don't think there would be a cover up on that for one reason. The best thing that would, to me, in some ways, the best thing that could happen for Mike Montgomery a year ago would have been, oh, you know what, we found his ligaments torn in his elbow.
Right.
This explains it all. Okay, you're going to go have TJ, and when you come back, you'll have a 95-mile-an-hour fastball again, and and we'll just work on, you know, finishing up the final touches.
That hasn't been the issue, though.
Instead, he was bad in Double A last year.
And that's the biggest issue to me, is that he's just not the guy he used to be. What is that? That's a Fine Young Cannibal song. I'm half the man I used to be.
Right. And
that's Mike Montgomery, I mean, right now, without the falsetto.
Right
and,
now.
And he doesn't also, JJ, the biggest problem, I think, for Mike Montgomery, beyond the stuff not being what it used to be, is that he does not have the makeup. He has not handled adversity.
He doesn't have the confidence he used to have.
When he first bumped up against adversity, where we're going to make you're going to put your round peg into our square hole, he clashed, and that was his makeup in high school. He was the Rasheed Wallace of his high school basketball team. I love Rasheed Wallace, but he got multiple technical fouls and was thrown off his high school basketball team. He was like, okay, that's fine. I was going to go pitch. Oh, well, Trevor Bauer, my high school teammate, is better than me. He didn't have a great senior year, in part because I think he felt a little diminished in Trevor Bauer's wake. Then, you know, get the pro ball. It seemed like he thrived off the competition. It seemed like he and John Lamb fed off each other somewhat. But he hasn't reacted well to adversity, and the makeup, the hot-headedness, the not dealing with authority has always kind of been an issue with Mike Montgomery. Frankly, it's a little bit of an issue with Trevor Bauer. But these are some stubborn dudes, both of these guys. To me, Mike Montgomery has to look in the mirror for himself as the issue, no longer the Royals development issue. I think people who listen to this podcast know what I think of the Royals pitching development. I think it stinks. I think the track record speaks for itself. But Mike Montgomery's track record speaks for itself, too. Since he got a ball, he hasn't thrown enough strikes. He needs to kind of look in the mirror about that. And that's always been a critique of guys who long toss, is that it's more about arm strength and not about Ferguson Jenkins and Leon Mazzoni are two guys who were proponents of you don't need to throw anything more than 60 feet 6 inches. You practice to be on the mound. Yeah. So Mike Montgomery is kind of ammunition for the anti-long toss crowd in that he doesn't throw enough strikes to the fastball. And I don't think he's shown the mental ability, the toughness, the makeup to overcome that adversity and to get better, to make adjustments. And that's part of what baseball is. And when you're as athletic as Mike Montgomery was purported to be, you should be able to make those adjustments.
I was gonna say, he's athletic.
And he hasn't been able to make those adjustments. So it's disappointing because he has really – I think he had that promise in A-ball. That was not fluky. That was not some mirage. That was there. That was legit. And even if the breaking ball remained below average, if you're pitching with a 70 fastball and a 70 changeup, even a 60 fastball and a 60 changeup as a left-hander, that should be enough for you to be a major league starter of some import.
Right. Not just to, like, you could be a fifth
right.
starter. You're better than
so
that.
So I think there's a lot of fault. I think there's a lot of blame to share here. But I don't write the guy off completely either. To me, though, you have to see more than just a glimpse. He's got a – the fact that he basically is not pitching with a plus fastball anymore is pretty depressing.
And we got to see. I mean, that's where you – if you're – the reality is that this year, to me, he's like – not that the – you can't – it's hard to give up on a guy like that. But if you're the Royals, this year is kind of, to me, almost like the last rodeo for the Royals and Mike Montgomery in that
– yeah.
And not that he won't ever do something if he doesn't make it work this year, but if he comes back in 2013 and the fastball, you know, is more consistently, because he was still there was still 95 in there at times this past year. Like, you would see it at times.
That's important.
But you wouldn't see it consistently. And I think part of that was one, they made an adjustment where they kind of lowered his arm slot a little bit and the velo backed up a little bit with that, which they've kind of now gone away from. Then two was that I think he sometimes took a little off now because he knows he can't load. He wasn't locating, but if you don't see if the fastball is kind of more of a 90, 92, you know, touching 92, 93 in 2013 and the command's still the same. Well, at that point you almost have to say, okay, well, someone else is going to have to see if they can get something out of him.
Which prospect challenge trade would you make here? Would you prospect challenge trade Mike Montgomery for Tim Beckham? I think the Rays wouldn't do that. I don't think the Rays would do that.
No. The one that always jumps out to me would be, I think, you know, it would be something along the lines of, how about Mike Montgomery for Manny Banuelos? I think the Yankees don't do that because I think they believe in Banuelos a little bit more. But that would be one, Manny Banuelos for Mike Montgomery.
Mike Montgomery for Dellin Betances.
See, I think that one is funny. I think Mike Montgomery slots, if you were ranking those, I think he slots in between. Like if you said Mike Montgomery for Manny Banuelos, the Yankees are giving up too much there. Because I think there's more likelihood of Banuelos, if it all coming back together, than there is for Montgomery.
Sure.
But if you said Montgomery for Betances, I say that the Royals are giving up too much because I think there's a higher likelihood. I think Mike Montgomery.
But Dylan Betances is a fastball, curveball guy.
He is.
Bill Fisher would be like, excellent.
But if you said Mike Montgomery, the Yankees have already, with Betances, kind of said, well, this guy's probably, you know, this guy's a reliever. If Mike Montgomery, if you said tomorrow, you know what, we're gonna cash in our chips and we're just gonna move Mike Montgomery to the pen and say, you know what, throw your fastball as, you know, air it out for an inning. You can go throw a long toss pole to pole to get, you know, to build up arm strength and your changeup. You just don't even worry about that breaking ball. If you did that, I think he still right now has a decent chance to be a solid reliever.
I'm trying to think if there's some kind of – if they could have thrown in Mike Montgomery in the Irvin Santana trade and if the Angels had given something back. That would have been a perfect one. Where if I were the Angels, that's who I would ask for back. And I bet you the Royals would have said, here, take him.
But
I guess not, though.
We're going to wrap this around. To wrap it up, this is the question I wanted to ask. The Blue Jays make this deal, the big deal. What other teams out there are there – that fans should be like, man, I kind of wish that my team had done that. Is there a team that you can think of where you go, man, that would have actually – because there are –
I think most other major league teams are – I think other front offices are asking themselves, do we look into the Marlins enough? Do we know – do we have any inkling the Marlins were in this dump mode? Because I just saw yesterday – I was going through my Twitter feed yesterday. I was at my son's basketball game when the news broke. And so I was going through my Twitter feed, and I missed one of his baskets, which was very frustrating. Thankfully, he scored others. Humble brag. Hashtag yeah. Humble brag. But I was looking through my Twitter feed, and I saw earlier in the day Bob Nightingale tweeting about the Marlins being in on some free agent or some trade for a big leaguer. So that seems like the buzz out of the GM meetings was that the Marlins were trying to buy. And instead, they were selling, which, A, I think tells you – Alex Anthopoulos has been very good at keeping secrets as a major league general manager. So kudos to AA for that. Best Greek general manager in the game that I know of. So I only know of one. Number two, the Marlins were pretty good at keeping a secret that they were selling. I think just my conversations, a couple texts I sent yesterday, a couple of different scouts with big league clubs, was that no one had the sense that the Marlins were in this much of a sell mode. So I think that, again, the kudos go to Alex Anthopoulos that he sniffed this trade out, because I think all the other clubs that think their players would have liked to have gotten in on this.
But,
you know, like for example,
say,
the Brewers, for example, would have loved to have gotten in on a guy like a Mark Burley or a Josh Johnson.
Now, the tough thing with that, though, is that it also comes down to, did this trade have to be all together? Because if so, that does limit the number of teams. I know there's more money coming into them, you know.
But it does.
But it does, because, like...
But like,
you know,
if you're the Mariners,
say
you're the Mariners. The
Mariners
want to make a move. They have prospects. I think the Mariners would have been interested in this kind of a trade, and they have players to offer. Hey, you want a minor league shortstop? We got Nick Franklin or Brad Miller. Hey, you want some minor league pitching? We could spare you James Paxton without maybe Brandon Maurer without having to touch our top guys, Tawan Walker and Danny Holson. They have the prospect depth to have made that kind of deal happen.
But the thing about this is that I don't know, though, if you're the Mariners, and maybe you do. Like, the interesting thing is I think there are more teams out there that the component parts, because if you're the Mariners, you probably actually want to do a little bit less of this deal.
Maybe, yeah.
You may, because if you're the Mariners, the reality is that, not that Mark Burley and Josh Johnson aren't nice guys to add to this trade, but really it's the Jose Reyes, you know, maybe Emilio Bonifacio part of this trade that's more interesting for you. I do the Royals list. If you're the Royals,
yeah,
Johnson and Burley. If you could swing a deal, say like, okay, we're gonna, you know, we'll take on those contracts happily,
right,
and run the risk on that, but we don't want to add the gazillion years of backloaded,
sure,
Jose Reyes part of the deal.
There are only a few teams in my mind that really wouldn't have been interested, and that's teams that are set at shortstop that would not want to take Reyes's contract at shortstop. But even then, if you do, you probably have a chance to spin your shortstop to the Rangers or to someone else who's looking to make these deals,
right,
involving big league shortstops.
The tough part of it, though, is that when you put it all together and you get to $150 million, $155 million in commitment,
right,
at that point then, because, I mean, the team that jumps out to me that, like, the team that if this could have worked out for them, and would have been the Pirates. If the Pirates could have – I know it sounds crazy.
Yeah, it does.
But if the Pirates had swung this deal
– Pirates.
That would have changed the entire dynamic as far as – like
that's a great point,
that would
JJ.
Have, to me, the marketplace in Pittsburgh. Because that is a marketplace that wants to believe in their team.
But I think for 5 minutes they would have thought about that trade, and they would have thought about Ben Roethlisberger's shoulder. I mean, seriously,
no, I mean, but,
as a Steeler
but,
fan, don't you know that? Like,
no,
don't
but
you think that?
I think right now they're the third team in the market. There's no doubt about that.
Well,
including the second team is not playing right now at all.
Wow, but, that's quite a statement.
But the reality of it is, though, is just that, like, but
it's
if
a great
you look
ACC
at,
market
but if you
now,
look
too,
at it, though, to me, if you're the Pirates – that would have been like they're a team that actually I don't know that they probably don't have the budget room. They've just locked they managed to, you know, they kept their guy.
But if you wanted to, but if you wanted to change the conversation about your franchise, that's the way you do it. I agree with you. That's a great point. I mean, that's another reason why it's so vital for the Blue Jays to have done this, because it does make them relevant for the first time really in a long time. I mean, since Roger Clemens was there and Roy Halladay was there and they were winning some Cy Young awards, but it was all individual awards, not
the thing about this is that I think you compare this of the two giant dumps, this one versus the Red Sox, you know, Red Sox Dodgers move. Yeah,
I'm a
chuckle,
child.
Chuckle.
I'm a child.
But if you look at the difference between those, I do think that there's less. This one's less albatrossy. For the acquiring team,
it is less
to make up a word. You know,
I agree.
Like if you look
it's
at
it's less of a millstone. There are fewer millstone contracts here, especially when you talk about Johnson only has one more year, and Burley. To me, the durability, the fact that he's always healthy, you're going to get some value out of that contract, even if he's a fifth starter instead of a first number one starter.
You're going to. The reality is he's not going to be worth the contract you're paying him probably at the end of that deal. But you know what? That's compared to. You don't know what you're getting from Carl Crawford in the
right.
remaining years of that deal.
Right.
And you're basically taking on a lot more money in the Carl Crawford deal than you are in the Mark Burley portion of this. Yeah, and Jose Reyes, the reality is that Jose Reyes is 1 year removed from the money that he got from the Marlins wasn't considered that outlandish on the free agent market.
Absolutely not.
So that you're getting that contract in some ways at a little bit of a discount because you're not having to pay on your
– and as we've detailed, it's very hard to find shortstops. If you're going to pay for something, pay for a guy who can actually play major league shortstop.
Whereas Carl Crawford's a left fielder.
I agree with you. It's less millstone-y / albatross-y. So
I like that.
On that truthiness note, Stephen Colbert can ask us for more advice on made-up words, although I think he kind of has that on lockdown. Great podcast. Look forward to JJ's edit of it, and we'll drop that on BaseballAmerica.com and iTunes. If you ever have questions for the podcast, you can send them to us at podcast@BaseballAmerica.com, tweet at JJ at JJCoop36, or tweet at me at John Manuel BA. For JJ, I'm John. We'll see you on the next BA podcast. So long, everybody.